The Big Story is brought to you by Scotia iTrade. There's a trader in all of us. Every so often, a little news story crosses the wires that seems like an interesting enough piece of information until you pause for a second and start to think through what it means.
This morning, a Chinese scientist says he has helped make the world's first genetically modified babies. The researcher says the twin girls' DNA was altered with a new tool that allows scientists to edit the genetic code.
When you consider the ramifications of that simple announcement, the world starts to change a little bit. Call it the if-then story. If it is possible to alter the genes of embryos, and not theoretically possible, but it just happened possible, then what happens next? The reaction to the news has already been intense, to put it mildly. The researcher at the heart of this story has already been suspended by the Chinese government. But in the big picture, that matters a lot less than the if-then at the core of this story. If this technology is out in the world, then will it be used? By whom? To do what? What does the world look like if this technology becomes widely available? And what does the world look like if it doesn't? Because it's not like banning it will undo the fact that it exists. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story. Daniel Munro is a visiting scholar at the Monk School of Global Affairs and Public Policy. He specializes in questions of ethics and technology. Tell us what happened in China.
So essentially, the situation is that the parents of, or the, you know, the potential parents of these two twins wanted to have kids, but the father is HIV positive. So the researcher Jiang Kuhei wanted to edit the genes so that the twins would have an HIV immunity. He's concerned that the, you know, HIV positive status would be passed on to the children.
Right.
And so wanted to, you know, edit the gene in order that they would have immunity. So the two twins are essentially the product of in vitro fertilization and that gene editing process.
And that's believed to be the first babies.
From what I understand, yeah. I mean, it's hard to know exactly what's happening in all of the labs around the world.
Yeah, of course.
But, you know, this particular researcher, you know, clearly wanted people to know what he had done. And so said, yes, here, this is what we did. And you know, here you go. So to the best of our knowledge, yeah, the first two babies that are a result of gene editing, that what? Have had gene editing as part of their development.
What was the initial reaction like?
You know, I've looked at this quite a bit. I think for the most part, it has been, almost universally negative. There's been almost universal condemnation. I think the best that can be said among reactions for what he's done is a cautious skepticism. There are, you know, at least a couple people who say, you know, they want to see what emerges, what has happened. They want to look at the process a little bit better. But that's the best. That's the most positive reaction I've seen. Everything else that I've looked at is sort of universal condemnation.
Where does that come from?
Well, I mean, I think there's sort of two ways in which I think people are reacting. Well, three ways in which people are reacting to this. So there's a popular reaction that is a kind of, to put it technically, there's a kind of ew, gross, icky reaction.
Nice.
Among the public, just this kind of, you know, misunderstanding or you know, a concern about what's happening without being able to pinpoint exactly what the issue is. For bioethicists and some of the scientists who have looked at this, I think the reaction falls on you know, sort of one of two lines, and sometimes both. One is a concern about the lack of due process, lack of sort of ethical thinking and process on the part of the researcher. So he seems to have been very cavalier about ethical issues. There seems to have been some kind of consent process. So the parents who were involved were informed of what was happening and signed some kind of consent form. But the extent to which they were, you know, really told about the issues is not entirely clear. And there seems to be very limited sort of ethical consideration or engagement on the part of the university, anyone else on his team, and other scientists who, you know, could have provided some sort of, you know, independent assessment of things, but who were not consulted. So on the process side of things, you know, there's condemnation that he simply just didn't appear to care about this stuff, right? Or at least go through the processes properly. Then there are also concerns about the consequences of this, and that breaks down in a few ways as well. You know, there are concerns about, I mean, one of the big ones is just the uncertainty around this, the number of unknowns. So essentially what's happened is, you know, the researcher through this process has not simply edited the genes of the twins, but edited what's called the germline. So not only, and in fact, it's only one of the twins that has an HIV immunity now. It either didn't take or it wasn't introduced in the other one. This is still sort of unclear. But so for the one where it did take or where it was introduced, that's not just a change in her genes. It's not something that she will have but not pass down to her kids. In fact, this is something that she will pass down if she has children for generations, right? So this is a permanent change in what's called the germline. And we don't know what the consequences of that kind of thing will be in the long term. So there are all kinds of, you know, prohibitions and laws and regulations against this kind of stuff. There's other places where it's a little bit murkier, but basically people, we don't know what's going to happen. So until we know more about what's going to happen, there's a general aversion to doing this, and sometimes a, you know, legal prohibition on doing this. There's also concerns sort of more broadly about what this means for society, right? I mean, one
yeah,
is
that's the big one.
Exactly. I mean, you've got this new, so you've got like germline gene editing into the population. So concerns about what exactly, you know, will happen there. But there's also tricky issues around, you know, so in this case, I mean, you sort of step back and you say, of course, nobody really wants to have an HIV infection, right? And there are other sorts of conditions that obviously you would prefer not to have. And you would think, you know, better to edit the genes of you know, embryos and human beings so that they don't develop these sorts of things. That seems, I mean, not entirely unreasonable if it weren't for all these other sort of unknowns.
Right. You could wrap your head around that, but where does it go from there?
Exactly. But the issue is that it opens the door to essentially thinking about what kinds of traits we do and do not want to pass down to you know, future generations. And we have sort of fundamental disagreement about what constitutes, you know, a good or a bad trait, right? I mean, in certain situations, I mean, take disabilities, for example, right? On the one hand, it appears like if, you know, you have some kind of physical, you know, anomaly that prevents you from doing things that other people are able to do, we say that you might have a disability and maybe you would prefer not to have that, right? The tricky thing is that what constitutes a disability is not just a function of the capacities people have, but the society in which they operate, right? So if I, you know, say I have a visual impairment and I want to cross the street, I really only have a disability if crossing the street requires me to use some kind of visual cues, like seeing a walk sign or, you know, a flashing hand sign. If the cues instead are sound-based or oral, then I'm not disabled in that particular sense, right?
Yeah.
So you can have debates about that. But then, you know, at the further end of the spectrum, there are certain traits that, you know, people might want their children to have in order to have an advantage, or traits that they don't want them to have so that they're not disadvantaged, not necessarily disabled, but disadvantaged. I read, so this isn't confirmed, but I read something very peculiar about this particular experiment, right, is that this exact process, when it was trialed on mice, shows that not only does it develop HIV immunity and immunity to some other you know, viruses as well, it actually showed cognitive enhancement among the mice that were sort of the subjects of experiment, right? So there's a big unknown about whether in addition to, you know, providing HIV immunity for at least one of the twins, whether she will also have cognitively greater powers than would be the norm. And that's where I think things get really, really dicey and tricky from an ethical point of view.
Up next.
Not only a researcher at university, but he's also involved in some for-profit startups as well. And there are concerns that there are financial motivations here.
We all have investment goals, and Scotia iTrade can help you reach yours. Access free tools and resources to sharpen your investment skills. Visit ScotiaiTrade.com to start direct investing today. Scotia iTrade, there's a trader in all of us.
When you hear this story initially, you do kind of think that if we could eliminate some of the things that make life really tough for people around the world, that you would do that. But when you start talking about what we could be changing underneath the surface without even knowing it, I mean, like, I'm not trying to be callous about that, but that is the premise of a lot of futuristic fiction in which things don't end very well.
Yeah. I mean, and the real problem on those sorts of things is that in the first place, you know, for in the early stages and in countries where you don't have sort of equal access to these sorts of texts. So theoretically, right, let's say that this is opened up, right? People have access to making genetic modifications of their children, right? And in some cases, you know, you would think that these are things that you might want to do. In other cases, you might want to do for your own kids, but you hope that other people don't do for their kids, right? That kind of thing. But so in places where there's equal access to this kind of thing, you know, you're going to get different results based on the different values that people have about, you know, what they think is appropriate or inappropriate, right? So who picks up essentially or who uses this kind of service will differ depending on people's values. In places where the distribution of the technique is not equitable, right? So whereas, you know, people who have resources can get it, but people who don't have resources don't get it. So not only do you get, you know, sort of advantages for those people who already have advantages, but you get these things perpetuated through generations, right? I mean, again, this is a germline, what we call a germline gene edit, which means it will be passed down from generation to generation. It's permanent.
It is building the class system into your genetics.
Well, this is really the concern, right? I mean, it does sound sort of sci-fi fanciful, but I mean, this is how these things go. They start out sort of, you know, incrementally, and those, you know, incremental changes over time accumulate into pretty substantial advantages, right?
Yeah, what kind of discussion around this already exists in kind of the bioethics community? Because I know this might be the first real-world example that we're hearing about, but certainly, like, theories that this was happening or this could be possible have been happening for some time now, right?
Yeah, I mean, so the scientific and bioethics community has been concerned about this for decades, really, right? Ever since we've been doing, you know, sort of genetic research, and they've been organized around it too. So you go back to like 1975, there was something called a similar conference on recombinant DNA that brought together a bunch of scientists who were doing sort of genetic research, as well as, you know, legal scholars and philosophers to talk about, you know, how we should think about these sorts of things, how we should think about the risks, how we should think about regulating them. And, you know, at that conference, the general consensus was that, I mean, for germline editing, for example, there should be a prohibition on that kind of thing. And essentially for genetic editing, there should be a prohibition on this kind of thing until more is known about the effects. And that, I mean, from 1975 to the present, I mean, that's varied a little bit, right? I mean, I think the door has opened a little bit more. So whereas you used to see, you used to hear people saying that there has to be broad social consensus on gene editing before we can allow it to happen. Now we're seeing a sort of a bit looser language. That is, there has to be public discussion before we allow gene editing, which is, I think, is not quite as strong as saying there has to be broad public consensus, right? Nevertheless, you know, I think there is still a great aversion to this among, you know, the scientists involved in this and the bioethicists and philosophers. And this, you know, this researcher, Jiang Qu He, you know, is really viewed as a rogue. So, I mean, I find that actually encouraging, right, that there has been such a critical reaction and, frankly, thoughtful reaction to what has happened over the past few days.
How does the doctor defend himself?
Well, yeah, I mean, he was at a conference in Hong Kong at which he answered a number of questions that were posed to him about the process and why to do it. And frankly, I mean, you know, I've read the transcript and his answers are pretty unsatisfactory, at least from my perspective, right? I mean, there does seem to be some evidence that he's aware that there are ethical concerns, but no evidence that he has really thought through these things in, you know, a rigorous, careful way, right? I mean, in his mind, the fact that the father of the twins was HIV positive was a sufficient condition for thinking about you know, genetic editing to prevent that from being passed down to the kids. And the fact that it was possible to do this was sufficient for him to actually do it, right? Whereas there are, you know, a range of other possibilities to deal with, you know, a parent who is HIV positive, who doesn't want to pass that on to, you know, the children, range of other possibilities that he just simply did not seem to really think through, right? The other concern, and this, you know, comes out in some of the stories, is that he's not only a researcher at a university, but he's also involved in some for-profit startups as well. And there are concerns that there are financial motivations here, right? So it's not simply about the health and well-being of these kids, but about, you know, what this might be able to do for the for-profit companies that he's involved in.
Do we have any idea how long it would be until we know more about the long-term consequences? I mean, I guess the easy answer is until this baby grows up.
Yeah, and I think that's it. So some questions that the researcher has been asked are around, you know, what are the protocols around following, you know, the children's progress over time to watch for effects. I think, I mean, one, obviously you want to see what happens to these kids as they grow up. So, I mean, you're looking at whatever their lifespan is, for starters, but also what happens in subsequent generations, right? So when they have children, do we see any sort of changes in or unexpected effects in their children and their children's children? So, I mean, you know, on the one hand, the science is moving exceptionally quickly, such that we can actually see these things happening. But understanding, you know, how long, understanding the effects will really be sort of a multi-generational thing. That's going to move, I think, really slowly.
Well, you kind of swim in this stuff. So what was your first gut reaction when you must have seen the Wire story or a headline or something?
So frankly, my first gut reaction was not to believe that it was true, right? That I initially thought, here is somebody looking for publicity about what they may or may not be doing, but that they probably did not actually pull it off. And there were a few skeptical stories at first, but my initial sort of knee-jerk reaction was to disbelieve that it had actually been done. My second reaction was, okay, well, maybe it has been done, and this is probably a really bad thing.
Where do we go next?
Where do we go next? Well, I mean, this is the million-dollar question with any sort of new and emerging technology. You know, I think what we want to do is to take a look at what happened here, both in terms of, you know, the actual science, right? Is it the case that what was claimed to have been done has actually occurred? What are the sort of side effects or other consequences of that? But also, you know, to continue to think about the ethical issues around this thing and to get those people, again, those people who have the technique or the potential to have the technique to do these sorts of things, to think about the ethical questions. I'm optimistic about the scientific community as a whole, thinking about, you know, the morality of these sorts of things. But I think, you know, continuing to push students and, you know, new researchers to think about these things explicitly is probably the best we can do.
Fair enough. Thanks so much, Dan.
Thank you.
Dan Munro, visiting scholar at the Monk School of Global Affairs and Public Policy, a specialist in the area of ethics and technology. That was The Big Story, brought to you by Scotia iTrade. You can visit scotiaitrade.com to start direct investing today. For more from us, as always, thebigstorypodcast.ca is your destination on your web browser of choice. Also, you can find us on social media, at Big Story Podcast, on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram. Give us a shout. We would love to hear from you. And give us a rating and a review on your podcast application of choice. Every review helps people. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath-Rawlings. We will talk tomorrow.